Today is Wednesday, January 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Democratic-led House of Representatives convened Tuesday to discuss efforts to remove U.S. President Donald Trump from office.
They can transfer peacefully the powers of the president to the vice president.
But the president didn't seem too concerned.
The 25th Amendment is of zero risk to me.
Plus updates on the FBI's investigation on those who attacked the Capitol. We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. House of Representatives has begun discussing the Democratic-led chamber's effort to remove U.S. President Donald Trump from office. During a virtual House Rules Committee hearing, Maryland Congressman Jamie Raskin said that Vice President Mike Pence and the cabinet must act to remove President Trump.
They can help to lead us out of the nightmare that we've been plunged into by this sequence of events. They can transfer peacefully the powers of the president to the vice president, Mike Pence, for the remainder of this term so we can have a peaceful transition of power.
Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan dismissed the effort as just another Democratic bid to get rid of the president.
They failed with the Russia investigation, they failed with the Mueller investigation, and they failed with their first impeachment investigation. So here we are again, considering another divisive effort to go after President Trump.
The president, for his part, didn't seem too concerned on Tuesday.
The 25th Amendment is of zero risk to me, but will come back to haunt Joe Biden and the Biden administration.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson is following the story.
So the debate in the Rules Committee Tuesday morning was really our first taste of the debate that will really be playing out on the House floor for the next day or two over the president's role in that insurrection at the U.S. Capitol last week. It's going to give us a sense of, you know, where Democrats and Republicans fall, because as we know, some Republicans have broken with the president, have called for his resignation, have called for the 25th Amendment to be invoked. And we know that some of them may be considering a vote for impeachment in the House. Liz Cheney, who is one of the members of Republican leadership in the House, has said that she considers it a vote of conscience and may be voting in favor of it. So this really showed us where everybody is falling as this debate is playing out, as they all come back into town to prepare for what is really this historic vote. The first time a U.S. president has been impeached twice.
And speaking to reporters, the president was fairly dismissive of the impeachment effort.
The impeachment hoax is a continuation of the greatest and most vicious witch hunt in the history of our country, and is causing tremendous anger and division and pain, far greater than most people will ever understand.
So, Catherine, there are a couple of things on the table here, this House Resolution 21 and then potentially articles of impeachment later on in the week. So what can you tell us about what's taking place on Tuesday evening?
Right. So the vote that's happening Tuesday night is basically the U.S. House of Representatives calling on Vice President Mike Pence and a majority of cabinet members to invoke the 25th Amendment, which says gives the power to temporarily remove power from the U.S. president if the cabinet and the vice president feel that he is incapacitated or not able to perform the duties of the president. By all indications, Vice President Pence is not going to invoke that amendment. What this does is give Democrats kind of some cover to say, look, we gave the White House an option before we went with the nuclear option of impeachment, particularly impeaching Trump for a second time. That resolution is expected to pass, but of course it's non-binding. It doesn't require Mike Pence to do anything legally. We will roll on very quickly towards the next step in this process, which is an impeachment vote on Wednesday.
Speaking of that upcoming impeachment vote, this once more is a Democratic-led effort in the House of Representatives. Last time when the president was impeached, the Republicans were fairly unified. Based on your reporting, what are you seeing this time with the Republicans?
What I'm seeing is that this is different in many ways from the impeachment last year, because as Democrats are arguing, the evidence is right out there in the open. This is something that is really doesn't require a lot of debate. You either think that the president incited that insurrection or you don't believe that he did. And because of that, there are a handful of House Republicans who are likely going to vote for that one article of impeachment. A lot of what House Democrats did over the weekend was to very carefully craft that one article so that it would be very sharply focused, there wouldn't be a lot of debate over details, and that it would give Republicans a way to vote very easily for that charge. That's something that they hope will get more of their colleagues on board. From my reporting, it seems like they might get about 10 House Republicans for that effort.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. In a letter to Speaker Pelosi, Vice President Pence said that he did not feel like invoking the 25th Amendment was in the best interest of the nation. As U.S. President Donald Trump boarded Air Force One on Tuesday on his way to the southern state of Texas, he denied any responsibility related to the attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6th.
So if you read my speech, and many people have done it, and I've seen it both in the papers and in the media, on television, it's been analyzed, and people thought that what I said was totally appropriate.
Speaking in Alamo, Texas, at a border wall event, the president further spoke about the riot.
As I have consistently said throughout my administration, we believe in respecting America's history and traditions, not tearing them down. We believe in the rule of law, not in violence or rioting.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says President Trump is doing what he always does, passing the buck.
He blamed the violence that he helped cause on others. He blamed the divisiveness that he regularly caused on others. He blamed so much on others.
Speaking to reporters Tuesday afternoon, the FBI Washington Field Office Assistant Director in Charge, Stephen Duontuono, provided this update on the riot investigations thus far.
In 6 days, we have opened over 160 case files, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. The significance of this investigation is not lost on us. This is a 24/7 full bore extensive operation into what happened that day.
Duontuono said that no stone would be left unturned as the FBI carries out its investigations, and that the attack on the U.S. Capitol would not be tolerated. Acting U.S. Attorney Michael Sherwin provided additional information about the charges.
FBI working with the U.S. Attorney's offices across the country, and the crux of those being in D.C., we're looking at significant felony cases tied to sedition and conspiracy.
And he added that this was only the beginning.
So of those 170 cases that have already been opened, and I anticipate that's going to grow to the hundreds in the next coming weeks, we've already charged over 70 cases. And again, that number, I suspect, is going to grow into the hundreds.
Sherwin said that the scope and scale of the investigation was unprecedented.
So just the gamut of cases and criminal conduct we're looking at is really mind-blowing.
Those speaking said that not only would the investigation be thorough, but that those involved were in it for the long haul. On Monday, the FBI said it was investigating possible armed protests around the country. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden is following that story and gave me this update.
Well, the FBI says that it is taking very seriously threats that it's read on social platforms, messaging boards, and the like, suggesting that there could indeed, in the week to come, and perhaps a little bit afterwards, leading up to the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden, be armed protests, potentially violent protests, in all 50 states and in the Capitol, in Washington itself. And so they are looking at that. Some states are more concerned than others. For example, the state of New Jersey says it's been looking into this and is aware of threats that are out there, of people doing a lot of talking. But officials in New Jersey say as of right now, they don't have any specific credible threat about violence. But officials in the states also note that it may not take much if you have an event happening in one place, if you have violence breaking out in one area, that could be enough to inspire other individual actors, lone wolves, if you will, and you could have problems elsewhere. So they are communicating with each other. They are taking precautions and again, hoping for the best as they do all of this.
Jeff, we mentioned on yesterday's program that the National Guard is going to deploy upwards of 15,000 troops for the inauguration in Washington, D.C. in preparation for possible protests there. But what can you tell us about safety measures around the country?
Well, the biggest show of force is going to be in D.C., where you're going to have National Guard members working with the D.C., the Washington Metropolitan Police, working with Capitol Police, working with the FBI, working with the Secret Service to make sure that events are safe. Parts of the Capitol already, parts of Washington, D.C., are experiencing some closures. National Parks, which is in charge of the National Mall, is saying be prepared for additional closures. For example, the Washington Monument, not going to be open, not going to be available to members of the public. So you're already seeing that in Washington. And then in states around the country, aware of the potential of threats to their Capitol buildings, to their federal government buildings, to their state administrative buildings and courthouses, are each taking measures as they see appropriate, again, trying to calibrate the response to the threat.
And what about the larger role of the military in general in preparation for these possible armed protests?
Well, right now, the military is providing the National Guard. It's a tricky situation for military officials because, again, these are not situations in which traditionally the inauguration of a president where you have a large show of military force. It is simply not the American way when you have a transfer of power. That said, the military is worried. There have been investigations into whether or not some military members, active military members, took part in the riot at the U.S. Capitol last week. And there are concerns that in this hyper-polarized political environment that things could go wrong. And so just hours ago, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the office of the highest-ranking U.S. military officer, put out a memo to all the U.S. armed forces and warned that they need to embody the values and ideals of the United States. And the memo also warned that any act to disrupt the constitutional process is not just against, in the words of the memo, against American traditions, but it is against the law. And the memo further, the Joint Chiefs of Staff further emphasized that on January 20th, 2021, that President-elect Biden will become the 46th commander-in-chief of the United States, and that the United States military will continue to uphold its duty to protect the nation and follow the Constitution.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. The attack on the U.S. Capitol has reignited criticism of social media and its alleged role in inciting violence. While Facebook and Twitter have banned President Trump, there are questions about the future of online speech. Tina Trin has that part of the story.
Last week's violence at the U.S. Capitol came after weeks of social media activity by President Donald Trump and others. Facebook was one meeting place. Jesse Lyric is the co-founder of Accountable Tech.
When you've got 3 billion people on a platform that is optimized for maximum engagement with no check from government, that's how we got where we are.
Social media giants such as Facebook, Twitter, and Snap responded by suspending or outright banning President Trump and some supporters' accounts. There's an effort to remove content such as the phrase "Stop the Steal," a rallying cry for those who say Trump really won the presidential election. Amazon Web Services, the web hosting provider for Parler, a conservative alternative to Twitter, took it offline, while Google and Apple banned the app from its app stores. Those who lost their digital perch are crying foul. Others say the shutdowns came too late and don't go far enough. There are renewed calls for laws on online speech and a push to reduce the power that tech companies have. Experts say more attention is needed as to what happens after so-called deplatforming.
That's the phase we're in right now, and it could be incredibly dangerous if we don't take that moment seriously.
Megan Squire is a professor at Elon University who studies the online activity of extremist groups.
It's not enough to just wash your hands of a person and say, well, they're not on my platform anymore. It really is what happens next.
And what happens next is pretty predictable, says Squire. Movement to alternative or alt-tech sites like Telegram surged in the wake of mainstream sites' actions.
A couple of the channels that I was watching were growing at, 100 and 200%.
For the internet giants like Facebook, Google's YouTube, and Twitter, This should be their moment of reckoning, says Jesse Larrick, co-founder of nonprofit Accountable Tech.
Their tools have been recruiters in many ways for these extremist movements. And so it's not enough to take action on individual pieces of content or individual users even. Like, they have to grapple with the extent to which they've been a primary driving force of all of this.
As the U.S. continues to learn more about what led to the chaos in the nation's capital, questions remain about the future of speech online. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Several past scientific studies have suggested that drinking coffee can be linked to health benefits, such as offsetting the relative risk of type 2 diabetes, liver, bowel, and breast cancers. A new study published in the journal BMJ Open proposes drinking several cups of coffee every day may also lower the risk of developing prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is one of the deadliest forms of cancer among men. The new study was based on an analysis of data gathered from 16 previous related studies involving over a million men. Researchers found that those who drank up to 9 cups of coffee each day cut their prostate cancer risk by 9%. Drinking at least 2 cups each day was associated with a 7% lower risk of localized prostate cancer. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Britain's Bank of England says that up to 7,000 financial service sector jobs have been lost since the United Kingdom left the European Union. When we last spoke to reporter Henry Ridgewell in London after the UK and EU inked their trade deal for Brexit, he noted that the fate of London's financial service sector was one item that still needed to be worked out. So I got him on the phone Tuesday to see where things stand.
It's a complicated picture with financial services, and many people in the city of London or other financial centres in the UK say that effectively for them, it was a no-deal Brexit.
Why is that?
Because the trade deal that was signed between Britain and the European Union largely covered goods. It didn't really cover much of the services sector, despite it making up 80% of the British economy. Now, that's not just financial services, that's all sorts of other services as well. But given that London is, by most accounts, the second most important financial hub in the whole world, it gives you some picture of the predicament that it finds itself in after Brexit and without any trade deal which allows it to do business in the European Union.
Now, Henry, when we last spoke, it was right after the EU and the UK inked that trade deal. So, you know, how does financial services come into play?
So the existing trade deal we have with the European Union allows for the free transfer of some goods across the border. But for example, if a bank or an insurance company in London wants to sell its products into the European Union, it can no longer do so freely. Before Brexit, it had what was called passporting rights, where the regulations and the qualifications of financial companies were recognized across the European Union. That's all gone now. And so there are two options left for financial services in Britain. Either each financial service company, whether it's a bank or an insurance company and so on, tries to adapt to each individual European country's regulations, or it tries to seek what's called equivalence from the European Union, where Brussels, where the European Union itself recognizes Britain's regulations as equivalent to its own, and that would allow those firms to operate in the European Union. But that hasn't happened yet. It's a matter of negotiation over the coming weeks and the coming months. Some sources that you speak to in London from the government say that the EU is playing political games with this, that it's delaying things to try to lure more money and more jobs out of London and into European financial centres like Paris or Amsterdam.
And speaking of jobs, I mean, we saw the announcement from the Bank of England with up to 7,000 jobs being lost in the financial services sector. What do we know about what happened to them?
The indication is that, most of those assets and most of those jobs have moved to the European Union and have been taken up by other workers, if you like, in the European Union. The workaround for financial firms who still want to operate in the European Union but who are based in Britain is effectively to open branches in the European Union, base themselves there, and that would allow them to continue operating within the EU territory. There are various estimates made as to the number of jobs and the amount of money that has gone. You mentioned there the Bank of England's estimate. Another one from the accountancy firm Ernst & Young suggests that 7,500 jobs have already gone up to December 31st, and that £1.2 trillion in assets, so what's that, about $1.6 trillion, has been transferred to the EU. By doing that, those financial firms can continue to operate in the European Union.
Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA from London. Colombia is warning potential migrants from Venezuela about an increase in child sex trafficking and exploitation cases in the country. VOA's Christina Smith has that story.
Along the Colombia and Venezuela border, authorities say human trafficking is a growing problem. In Colombia, cases jumped 23% between 2015 and 2019, and Colombian officials say most of the victims are Venezuelan refugees and migrants. Camilo Andrés Domínguez Cantillo says he was abused as a child in Colombia and then fell into a human trafficking network as a minor.
I fell into a prostitution network in Cartagena de Indias. Suddenly, due to the problems I had with my family, they didn't understand me and I didn't have their support. Then I met a person who was trafficking boys and girls.
Mayerlin Vergara Perez is the regional coordinator of the Renacer Foundation, which helps sex trade victims. She works in the Colombian city of Riohacha, near the border with Venezuela, and says she's seen the rise in child exploitation cases and the lasting impact it has on children.
When a child is a victim of sexual exploitation, there's a profound impact, not only physically, because there are sexually transmitted diseases, but there are psychological problems. There are great, deep emotional problems.
About 90 kilometers from Riohacha, Luz Marina is a community leader in what is known as La Pista, an area where hundreds of Venezuelan families have found a makeshift refuge. She is working to keep kids here safe.
We want our children to study and not get lost because they arrive late at night. They don't look for anything good in the streets. They seek to be raped.
According to UN Refugee Agency, the number of Venezuelan refugees and migrants in La Guajira exceeds 155,000 people, and experts here say gender-based violence is on the rise. The number of victims of transnational trafficking rose by 20% in the first 4 months of 2020, and most of them were young women between 10 to 30 years old, according to the UN Office of Drugs and Crimes.
We have formed a group of 90 community leaders who are currently in the field, observing women who are exposed to risk situations, whether women from Venezuela or from here.
Right now, the only help for victims is coming from organizations like the UN Refugee Agency, Enlace Mujer, and Renacer. The organizations are working in together closely to address the needs of Venezuelan refugees. Cristina Quecedo Smith, VOA News.
India's Supreme Court has indefinitely placed on hold three controversial farm laws that have triggered the biggest farmers' protest in decades and formed a committee to resolve the impasse between the government and the farmers. However, farm leaders spearheading the six-week-long stir vowed not to call off the protest. The standoff has seen tens of thousands of farmers camp on major highways on the outskirts of New Delhi, demanding the rollback of the legislation. The farmers' protest has emerged as a major challenge for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, with the government refusing to repeal the laws and farmers refusing to settle for anything less. The government has defended the laws, saying that they would modernize agriculture and help farmers raise their income. During the pandemic, some schools are able to go to a so-called hybrid model, where some students physically go to a school while others remain at home and log in virtually. VOA's Elizabeth Lee tells us about a robot connecting students and teachers in a hybrid classroom.
2020 has been a weird year for high school student Sophia Jensen.
It's very strange, especially considering this is supposed to be like the last year of high school, like the fun time. And it's also like the most important semester is first semester. And now it's just like all upside down.
Jensen's school, like others during the pandemic, is offering hybrid classrooms where some students are physically in school while others log in from home. One thing helping students and teachers feel more connected is this robot called Swivel. DJ Clovis is the director of special projects at Fairmont Schools in Southern California.
Imagine it almost if you had a student inside your classroom with a boom mic and a camcorder the whole time. And that's really what the Swivel does.
The Swivel includes a base that pairs with any mobile device. This base has a sensor and is able to track a marker with a built-in microphone worn by the teacher. Vlad Tettelbaum co-founded Swivel.
Swivel robot, which is in essence follows the teacher around the classroom and focuses the video camera on them.
Again, DJ Clovis.
It's giving our teachers their legs back to be able to teach in a classroom, to be able to walk around.
The teacher can use common video conferencing apps with Swivel. It's better than just teaching with a computer, says science teacher Sarah McGuire.
The students could actually see the kids that were physically here in the classroom.
Jensen says tech-savvy teachers have no problem with Swivel, but for other teachers, there could be user error.
The Swivel doesn't really follow them around the room. It'll sometimes just spin in like a random direction, and then they'll have to like chase after it. But when it does work, it's really nice because then it doesn't feel as much like I'm just staring at a screen. It feels a little bit more like I'm in a classroom.
Even when schools go back to normal, teachers say the Swivel can still help students who are out sick plug in to their classroom. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Just enter that address on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device. And don't forget, with our top-of-the-hour newscast, you can always be up to date 24 hours a day. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 1993, having determined that the government of Sudan was harboring and supporting terrorists, including the leader of the Al-Qaeda terrorist organization, Osama bin Laden, the United States designated Sudan a state sponsor of terrorism. Such a listing has serious consequences. The country in question becomes an international pariah. Investors avoid a designated country while other countries are wary of dealing with it. The United States is barred from providing many kinds of direct assistance, imposes a variety of export controls, and works to oppose lending to such a country from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. A designation as a state sponsor of terrorism limits a country's ability to participate in the global economic system. The designation also costs Sudan its sovereign immunity, a legal doctrine that makes governments immune to civil suits or criminal prosecution. As a result, victims of Al-Qaeda attacks and their families sued the government of Sudan for restitution in U.S. courts. In separate cases, U.S. courts ruled that Sudan owed reparations to the families of the victims of the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya, and to the families of 17 U.S. sailors who died as the result of a bomb attack in Yemen on the U.S. naval destroyer Cole. In August 2019, the people of Sudan overthrew its longtime dictator, and the new provisional government declared that its top priority was to rid Sudan of its pariah status and to join the community of nations once again. To that end, the government of Sudan agreed to settle the judgments against it by making available $335 million to be distributed among the plaintiffs. Following further review of Sudan's progress, on December 14th, the United States removed Sudan from its state sponsor of terrorism list. On December 28, the Consolidated Appropriations Act was enacted, which included language that provided a path towards the restoration of most of Sudan's sovereign immunities. This step represents a fundamental change in Sudan's relationship with not only the United States, but also the entire international community. It removes a major impediment to Sudan's full reintegration into the global economy by reducing the risk of attachment of Sudan's assets, opening the possibility for substantially increased trade and investment, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a written statement. We commend the Sudanese people for their continued insistence on freedom, peace, and justice.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.